All right, turning your Bibles to Mark chapter 15. I want to begin by reading our passage, which is going to be verses 16 through 23, excuse me, 28. 16 through 28. We are kind of in the midst of the crucifixion narrative at this point in the gospel. Verse 16, and the soldiers led him away inside the palace, that is, the governor's headquarters, and they called together the whole battalion. And they clothed him in a purple cloak, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on him. And they began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they were striking his head with a reed and spitting on him and kneeling down in homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the purple cloak and put his own clothes on him, and they led him out to crucify him. And they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. And they brought him to the place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull. And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. And it was the third hour when they crucified him. And the inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two robbers, one on his right and one on his left. Now, I want you to look carefully at verse 28 in this passage. Some of your Bibles don't even have it. Maybe you've got a 28 and then nothing after it. Some of you will have it, but it'll be in brackets. So some versions include it, others don't. So I just need to sort of get out of the way what's going on here. And that is that, like, what does this mean? Why do some versions have it, some don't? Even the ones that do have it have a notation next to it that indicates that it is, that there are not found in early manuscripts or the earliest manuscripts. So this verse, if it were there, and it, we do find this in Luke's gospel, is a reference to Isaiah 53:12. So it is possible that it was part of Mark's original writing of the gospel, and just somehow it was missing in the earliest manuscripts that we have. Also possible that later Christians, as they were copying manuscripts, recognized that this was a fulfillment of Isaiah 53:12, and so they added it as sort of an observational footnote. It is a helpful observation because it does point us back to what is prophesied, specifically the dividing of Jesus' cloak by the Roman soldiers. But even though it's a helpful observation, whether it was in the original or not, it does not affect what is going on, or even the gospel account. Because as we mentioned, it is included in other gospels, like Luke, for example. And we have all kinds of Old Testament prophecies regarding the Messiah that are not mentioned at all in the New Testament. I'll give you just one example, a well-known one. Isaiah chapter 9, verses 6 and 7. We quote it all the time at Christmas. It says this, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end, on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with the justice and righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this." All the time we reference this at Christmas. It's in Handel's Messiah, you know. But it's not referenced in the New Testament. That doesn't mean it wasn't a prophecy regarding the Messiah. All it means is it was a prophecy that the New Testament writers didn't see a need to call attention to. It's something that is. So, Mark chapter 15, verse 28, don't freak out when you're reading your Bible and you see the little 28 and there's no verse after it, or you see it in brackets. But that's what's going on there. What about this passage? The passage before us, what's going on? What do we learn from it? I think if I was sort of summarize what we're going to sort of unpack this morning, it's this, that there really are no shortcuts on the road to redeeming sinners. And what we see in this is that Jesus fully endured the whole process of paying the punishment for sins. And this is just part of it. One of the things that's so special about Mark's gospel, we've referenced it several times, is how compact it is. He gets sort of right to the point, and then he moves on to the next thing. He's just kind of, it's a steady little clip, which makes it so interesting that when it comes to the week of his crucifixion, how he does sort of get a lot more dilated so that we can see exactly what is going on here. But in this section, this little section of what's happening as Jesus is now moving from this scenario before Pilate to now his actual crucifixion, is we see how he is treated by the Roman soldiers. And the first thing that really comes to the forefront in all of this is their treatment of him is nothing short of mockery. That is sort of how they are regarding this. They are mocking this charge of King of the Jews, and so everything that flows out of it is not only derogatory towards him, but is very abusive. So this whole section involves the Roman soldiers. We know this because it starts by telling us the soldiers led him away, verse 16. But then if you were to sort of circle how many times we find the statement, and they, and they, and they, and they, and they. It is repeated throughout these verses, and it is a reference to these soldiers, how they are treating Jesus Christ, what they are doing. And the first thing the soldiers do is they have a little me time. We've got Jesus now. They've taken him away from the palace, if you will, where Pilate and the Roman officials were, and they've got him all to themselves. So let's have a little fun with this guy. They gather around Jesus to have fun at expense, and it is sort of mob mentality 101, right? It's a large group of soldiers behaving in ways that they would either lack the courage or the power to do, or even the desire to do if they were with him one-on-one. I mean, if you work with junior hires, specifically junior high boys, you see this play out on a daily basis in the cafeterias and school parking lots of the world. In fact, I kind of how I sum up the mindset of a junior high boy, if you're a junior high boy, no offense, I too was once a junior high boy. Junior high boys want so badly to be funny. They want their peers to think they are funny, but they don't know how to be funny. So their instinct is, there's two ways you can be funny. You can break things, or you can hurt people. That's the junior high mentality. This is how we be funny. Hey, look at that over there. It would be great if I threw it through the window. Wouldn't that be funny? Hey, look at that person over there. It would be funny if I punched him. Wouldn't that be great? This is how they're treating Jesus in this moment, this group of junior high Roman soldiers around him. It's mob mentality. That's kind of how we as a human race degrade whenever we get into these mob scenarios. It's a little bit like zebras. One-on-one, when the zebra's out on the safari by himself, he's in danger, right? But when he's in a group, he's not easily noticed because all the stripes create this sort of strobing mass of indistinguishable shapes. That's the mob mentality. When I'm in a big group, nobody will know it's me. I won't be able to get caught. I won't get in trouble. So the activities of this mob, these Roman soldiers, is designed to mock and humiliate Jesus, all playing on this title, King of the Jews. The robe they put on him is to sort of mock him. Oh, you're a king, let's put this raggedy robe we found on you, because kings wear robes. Oh, even the crown of thorns, we tend to make much of how painful it would be to have a crown of thorns pressed down on your head. But pain was not even really the point. That was just sort of an added bonus. It was mocking the laurel leaf crowns that the Caesars would wear. So instead of this laurel leaf, we'll put this raggedy crown of thorns on your head. The staff, Mark doesn't mention it here, but this little reed, in other Gospels, they point out that they give it to him to hold as like a scepter. Here, you want a scepter? Have this little stick over here. They salute him. They hail him in the way that they would Caesar. And so instead of hail Emperor Caesar, it's hail King of the Jews. They even bow down towards him. This is all mob mentality. They all think they're being funny. Hey, I got a funny idea. Look at this loser from Nazareth who thinks he's a king. Hey, you know what would be cool? What if you hit him in the head? That would be hilarious. Grab that reed and start hitting him in the head, dude. That would be so funny. Ha ha, what a loser. What a punk. You know, this is what's going on. I'm sure they're all just having a great little laugh. This is also a way not only to humiliate and intimidate Jesus, but it's also a way to poke fun back at the Jews, these religious leaders who have attempted to manipulate the Roman legal system in order to get Jesus executed, when even Pilate understood that they were just doing this out of envy. So they get to sort of have a little psychological abuse too. It's sort of like, hey, here's your king, you Jews who are trying to get us to do what you want us to do. In fact, that charge even seems to be particularly troubling to these religious leaders, because John tells us in his gospel, in John 19, verse 21, that they didn't want Pilate to put the sign that says King of the Jews up there. John says, so the chief priests of the Jews said to Pilate, do not write King of the Jews, but rather, this man said, I am King of the Jews. We don't want to claim that he's our king, that he's our ruler. Just say that he said he was. So, blinded by their sin, blinded by their ignorance, these Roman soldiers, in their mockery of Jesus, cannot even comprehend that he might actually be the Messiah, the anointed king that God has sent to deliver his people. The thought of this blows everyone's minds, because what king who had power and authority and dominion would let this happen? If he was this one who was going to deliver Israel, certainly he could deliver himself, right? Isn't that one of the charges that's going to be lobbied at Jesus? That you say you could save people, you can't even save yourself. But when you look at this scenario, starting at verse 16, this mockery that's taking place, the being surrounded by this, the English translation say battalion, it would be like a Roman cohort, which, you know, was a large, you know, the full cohort would be several hundred men. but it was most likely whatever of that battalion was there in with Pilate in this palace or whatever. The idea is that all the soldiers left, and they left with Jesus. So it's a large group, more than is necessary. But when you see all this happening, and the crown of thorns, and the robe, and the mocking, and the saluting, and the spitting on him, kneeling down and bowing to him, hitting him on the head with the reed, all of this kind of stuff, is you need to understand that Jesus doesn't have an understudy. He doesn't have a stunt double. He's enduring all of this himself. He's not sort of taking the easy way to the cross and the easy way out of this. I don't know if you've ever seen any of the older Jackie Chan movies, like from the 90s, that were in Chinese and dubbed over into English. They're great, phenomenal movies. But one of the things they all have at the end of them is they all have an outtake reel of all the times he got hurt or almost died, because that was one of the things Jackie Chan always did, his own stunts, right? If you didn't know that, now you do. He always did his own stunts. Before Tom Cruise made it cool, Jackie Chan was doing it. This is the same thing with Jesus. He does his own stunts. He doesn't have somebody else step in for him, and he'll just sort of wait in the background while they mock him and scourge him and put these mock clothes on him and harass him and hit him in the face and do all sorts of things to him. Doesn't receive any special treatment because he's the star of the show. Nobody said to him, hey, we know you're innocent. We know you don't deserve this. We know the Sanhedrin is trying to manipulate the system just to get you out of the way. Our hands are tied. We've got to do something, but because we know you don't deserve this, we'll make it as easy as possible on you. No, he went through it all. He went through everything. Hebrews 12, verse 2 says, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. What I think we should make sure we're careful to understand is that expression, despising the shame. In his humanity, he despised the shame of the abuse, the sin that was administered towards him, the mockery, all of that. It wasn't that he went through all of that with great joy and delight. The joy was the result of the process. The joy was being obedient to the Father and accomplishing the plan of redemption for us. That's what the joy is. The joy for him, and we've talked about this, in his humanity, he's agonizing having to go through this because it is really painful. It is truly difficult and challenging. The torture is real. And so there was not a sense in which, yay, I get to do this. No. It's part of God's plan. And we can look all the way back to Genesis 3:15, which we also often talk about as sort of like the embryonic gospel or the earliest gospel message, where Jesus, or it's not Jesus, but God tells the serpent in the garden that part of the consequence was that there was going to be enmity between him and the woman, and that her seed, he was going to crush the heel of her seed, but that seed would crush the head of the serpent. And we have understood that from the beginning to be a reference to the crucifixion and the cross and Jesus being the seed of the woman. Remember, born to the Virgin Mary, and that he is seemingly dealt a mortal blow, and yet he arises victorious over it. It's just a flesh wound in reality. He rises from the dead, and in that defeats the power of Satan and sin and death. And Jesus, in his humanity, did not get the easy way out, and he was not just loving every minute of this. This was truly agonizing for him. And yet, he endured it. Yet, he persisted through it. He was faithful in it. The mockery of Jesus lets us know the depths to which he was willing to go in order to accomplish the Father's will. Then we see from the mockery, they begin to prepare him for the crucifixion. All the mockery, all the abuse, after all of that, he is led out to where he would be crucified. It was very common practice that criminals who were going to be crucified would be lashed to the crossbeam if they were using a crossbeam to crucify. They didn't always do that, but when they did, they would lash the crossbeam to them, lead them out bearing that, and they would whip them while they were leading them out to the point where the place where they would actually be crucified. So that crossbeam was called the patibulum, and that would be then lifted up and attached to a vertical beam that was typically already in the ground, or it would be attached to a vertical beam on the ground and then raised up into a hole where that cross would be. John 19, verse 17, gives a little bit information, more information than we have here, in that John tells us that Jesus did initially leave with that beam, carrying it, as was typical of people being crucified. He was, verse 17 of John 19 says, he went out bearing his own cross to the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. And here we see that Simon of Cyrene is commandeered to carry this beam. So most likely what has happened is that Jesus, having already been scourged, we're told, is too weak to complete the journey. He starts off with it, but is unable to finish. And so they compel Simon of Cyrene at random to carry this beam to its final destination. And the fact that the soldiers do not demand that Jesus continue the whole way carrying this beam lets us know the level of abuse that he has already endured. They're not individuals who are known for being merciful. That's not the point of a crucifixion, to show mercy. The point is to prolong the agony and to make it as torturous as possible. So the fact that they don't force Jesus to carry it the full way indicates that he likely couldn't have done that, and they needed somebody else to do it in order to get him to where he would be crucified. We're also told here by Mark, as a part of this preparation, that he is offered this concoction, wine mixed with myrrh. And this was intent to be a type of narcotic to deaden the pain. Not, once again, not to be merciful, not to make it less torturous, but rather to sort of minimize the effects of shock so that Jesus can be on the cross longer before he succumbs to death. It's an attempt to prolong the crucifixion. And Jesus' refusal of it is further testimony to his resolution to endure the full, undiluted pain and penalty for sins. Remember, he's not going to take any shortcuts. He's not going to participate in anything that is somehow going to cause there to be an asterisk besides his name that, yeah, he did this, but he took all of the shortcuts. He did it as easy as possible. It probably shouldn't even count in the record books. No, that's not how it was. Any of you follow the Tour de France? We're Americans, so probably not. But The 1904 Tour de France was sort of legendary, notable for how many competitors attempted to cheat by hopping onto trains to speed them through certain parts of the race. In fact, it got so bad that fans were staking out train stations along the route and were beating riders that were trying to get onto the trains. They thought they were trying to cheat. The guy who ended up receiving the victory medal was not even the first one to cross the line. His time was 3 hours short of four other guys in front of him, and they aren't even sure that he didn't cheat as well. There's a lot of cheating going on in the early days of the Tour de France. Jesus didn't do that. Jesus didn't take any of these easy ways out just to get across the finish line. So I think for those of us who may be tempted to believe that all of this that we read in this gospel is unnecessary. Jesus didn't have to do this because God is too loving to send any sinners to condemnation and hell. That God's justice doesn't demand that. That he can just look the other way. If that were the case, then why would Jesus Christ willingly endure that? Why would he go through all this agony and torture? Why would he not cut corners? If all of it is just sort of superficial, if all of it is just sort of for show, it doesn't really matter, it doesn't really count, it's not even really needed. It doesn't make any sense. If it was all just symbolic, then we could assume that God at most would ordain a very sort of simple, superficial kind of death. Not a lot of pain, not a lot of agony, not a lot of suffering. I mean, I know people who have avoided going to the doctor for decades just because they're afraid they might have to get a shot. That is the honest to goodness truth. I know people like that. That is how averse to pain some people are. If shots can even be called pain. We still have in the United States, in a handful of states, the death penalty. 29 prisoners have been executed this year by the death penalty. All of them were convicted murderers. So, and most of them died by lethal injection. There are two ways they administer lethal injection in the United States now. One is a three-shot dose, and the other is a single shot. The three shots, the first shot is a sedative, the second shot is a paralytic, and the third shot is induces cardiac arrest. And the goal is to make it as painless as possible. It's to execute, but there's still to remain some level of humanity in the execution. The single dose shot is just an anesthetic that they essentially overdose the person on. They go to sleep and don't wake up. But this is not how Jesus died. He didn't die through a simple, painless, easy death. He didn't just fall asleep and never wake up till 3 days later. He was not killed humanely. He was killed with absolutely no dignity whatsoever, no regard for pain. In fact, the whole point was prolong the trauma as much as we can, because then we get the most out of it. And he went through all of this because there is no other way. This is why, as Chaz read in Acts chapter 4, as they are confronted for preaching Jesus, for preaching his death and resurrection, And Peter insists that they have to preach his death and resurrection because, as he says in verses 11 and 12, Jesus is the stone that was rejected by you, the builders, which has become the cornerstone, and there is salvation in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. There's no other possibility for salvation. The only way is through Christ, which is why he willingly endured all of this horrific treatment. He didn't demand, like, hey, can I get the easy way out? Can I die, but can I just go peacefully in my sleep? Can I die, but just go quickly? No, he took the necessary steps to accomplish God's perfect plan that allows God to be both just, because sin is punished, and justifier, provide justification for sinners through the substitution of this one perfect, sinless sacrifice. That's the only way. So we see they mock the king, they prepare the king, and then finally they crucify the king. It's very important for you to look at verse 24. If you have a Bible, a phone with a Bible app, whatever, you need to go to verse 24. It's important for you to look at this verse and notice this very casual, matter-of-fact way that Mark states what happened. He just says, and they crucified him. That's it. They crucified him. They took a person who they have already beaten, mocked, punched, spit on, and they put his arms out across that crossbeam and drove a nail between the bones of the wrist of his hands on one side and then the other, hoisted the beam up, put his feet together, and then drove a nail through his ankles, securing his feet to the vertical beam. He just describes it as, and they crucified him. Notice in that, as Mark matter-of-factly states that in verse 24, there is a absolute callous casualness that the soldiers regard Jesus and this whole affair. They've nailed somebody to these two rough-cut beams through his wrists and feet, and now they're going to play games for his clothes. So Mark, through his minimalist descriptions, paints this picture of a king being tortured and killed by soldiers who cannot even be bothered to care. This is really just all in a day's work for them. It is like the most significant event in human history, but for them, it's just an item on their to-do list. Many people are dismissive of the crucifixion, denying that it has even happened. This is one of the claims of Islam. In fact, in the Quran, in Surah 4, verses 157 and 158, we read this: "They neither killed nor crucified him. It was only made to appear so. Even those who argue for his crucifixion are in doubt. Rather, Allah raised him to himself." So within Islam, the two most commonly advanced theories about the crucifixion is one that it is someone else who was made to look like Jesus. They typically offer either Simon the Cyrene, who carried the cross, or Judas, who was actually nailed to the cross and crucified, or the second other position that they advanced, that it was all an illusion, and that people only thought they saw it. They're not the only ones who dismiss the crucifixion out of hand, but they certainly, that is a big component of one of the things that they contend against Christianity. that Jesus was not even crucified, that he just was taken up into heaven. Maybe you never thought about this, but we can be a lot like these soldiers or other people who are very dismissive of the crucifixion. For all our talk of living cross-centered lives, for all our talk of keeping our eyes on the cross, for all our talk of remember the cross, remember the crucifixion, remember the cross can often become a simplistic or even dismissive treatment of what Jesus Christ endured for sinners. Even oftentimes our cross insignias are a very sanitized reminder of what was required of Jesus for us to have salvation. I fear that somewhere between glamorizing the cross or reducing our response to the cross to just be grateful, we basically are treating it in a similar way to the Roman soldiers who nailed Jesus to the cross and then get on about having a good time. When we do ponder the cross, and we should, be cross-focused, we should be cross-centered, we should keep our eyes on the cross, we should look to the cross, we should lean on the cross. But when we ponder the cross and we do that, we should be patient, we should be purposeful, there should be an intensity in that act. It should not be sort of a Hallmark movie moment or a VeggieTales moment. Maybe Mark is showing us in this verse, verse 24, where he says, "They crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take." Maybe he's showing us how even believing Christians can be very casually dismissive of what the cross really means. We can look at it, and then just like the soldiers, we can turn away so we can get back to focusing on the world and the things of the world. The cross. Oh, look, it's football season. The cross. Oh, what's on TikTok since I looked at it 5 minutes ago? The cross. Hey, did you hear what Trump had to say today? Did you hear what Newsom had to say today? Hey, did you hear whatever had to say today? The cross. Oh, look, another Marvel movie. The cross. You want to complain about how expensive everything is now? The cross. Let's DoorDash some sushi. The cross. I mean, and we can just look at it and then we just get back on to the rest of our lives, as if we didn't even look at it at all, as if we didn't think about it at all, as if it had no effect on our day whatsoever. They crucified him. Let's go divide these clothes up, guys. We can do that, I don't think intentionally, but I think maybe because we've just become numb to it, maybe because it has just become a cliche, it has become rote, it has become just sort of something that Christians say they do. We have to be really careful that when we look to the cross, when we ponder the cross, when we think of the cross, that we really do. We really take the time to think about what did Christ endure so that my sins could be forgiven? What did Christ have to suffer and die for so that I could be blessed with? That's why I think the words of Isaac Watts in When I Survey the Wondrous Cross are so profound. The first verse, "When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, my richest gain I count but loss and pour contempt on all my pride." That's the call of having a true reflection of what Christ has done for us. He's saying, when I really think about it, that the best thing that I could possibly gain in this world is really just its complete loss. Similar to what Paul talks about when he shares his testimony in 2 Corinthians. "And I pour contempt on all my pride. How could I be prideful about anything when I think of what God has done for me through the death of Jesus Christ? Forbid it, Lord, that I should boast, save in the death of Christ my God. All the vain things that charm me most." Yes, arguing about politics and TikTok and DoorDash and all those things I mentioned. They can be so fun, right? But they're so hollow. Like Ecclesiastes, right? Vanity of vanities. It's all vanity. I sacrifice them to his blood. I don't think this means that every moment of every day we just have to be in deep, obsessive pondering about the suffering of Jesus Christ for sins. But what I would encourage you to be called to is that when you do take time to do that, that you really do it. That you really pause from the rest of your life. That you set those things aside. That you are focused and present in those moments of thinking about the cross. And that when you do, you are not quick to rush away from it back to the things that you really want to be doing. And this is so hard. I mean, I would be the first to admit it. Because our world is designed to make us easily distracted. It's designed to be easily accessible and to be low effort to engage in these things. That's the way they are created to be, and they're really good at it. And that's the way we're wired too. We have to fight against our sinful pride, our selfishness. Focus on the humility of Christ and what he has done for us. So my encouragement, when you come to a passage like this, and when you come to a verse like verse 24, that does state it just so very matter-of-factly, that you take that not as like, oh, we should treat it very matter-of-factly as well, but that should almost be jarring to read it in that way and almost say, wait a minute, what is he talking about? He's talking about the King of the universe being nailed to a cross to suffer and die so that sinners might be saved from their sins, to be brought into a relationship with God, to be adopted into his family, to be made heirs of his kingdom, to be rescued from an eternal damnation. That's what it means. When the impact of the cross is deep and intense because of our sincere reflection on it, I think it will have dramatic impact on our lives. I think it will help us to hate our sin when we really think about the cross. I think it will motivate us to love God, the Father, Son, and Spirit. I think it will produce in us a desire to see sinners surrender their lives to the gospel. I think it will build within us a sense of peace and joy knowing what Christ has done on our behalf. It will give us an assurance that our sins are forgiven because we understand that Jesus paid it all. He didn't take any shortcuts. He didn't cut any corners. And it helps us to realize that the silly things that so easily occupy so much of our time. I think that's the real kicker, right? It isn't that these things occupy our time, it's just how much of our time they occupy. that those things will, it will help those things to fade into the background. Jesus Christ did not cheat the system. He didn't cut corners. He didn't take any shortcuts. He endured the full punishment for sins so that we could be saved. Let's pray. Dear Lord, what a joy it is to take time from our day, even this morning, and to reflect on all that Christ endured in the pursuit of saving sinners. We thank you that victory was assured from the beginning, that that was what is promised all the way back in the Garden of Eden. There was never any doubt, there was never any question as to whether or not he would be successful. And even with that assurance, there was not any, there were not any corners cut. It was not just sort of a false facade that was put on to make it appear one way when really it was something else. No, he stepped into history, lived and walked among us, and endured the very worst so that we might receive the very best. Help us to be free from a casualness about what Christ endured. And that when we do take time from our days to spend time reflecting and being cross-focused, that we would dwell on the full reality of what that was and not give it just a passing glance. I ask this in your name. Amen.